Hare Krishna. Thank you all for coming. So this is our second session. We're in Split. And what's the date today? The 29th, is it?
Yeah.
Yes, 29th. It's for the recording. Is everybody okay with English? Do we need some translation? Oh, you're all there in one group. The others, you can come forward if you like. Don't, you know, you don't have to be scrunched up all at the back there. Okay, we're going to continue on then with Srila Prabhupada, the living Bhagavatam, and Prasadam pastimes. Yesterday we talked about how not to entertain your guests with the dog food that was distributed in Hyderabad in 1976. I also had an occasion when, although Prabhupada didn't chastise me at all, but he expressed some disappointment because I failed to entertain my guests properly. That was when we had arrived in July 1976, and my parents had come to see me at Bhaktivedanta Manor. So they were living in the north of England. They had to drive about 4 hours to get there. And they came on a Sunday afternoon, and it just happened that Srila Prabhupada decided that morning that he wanted to go to Bury Place to see Sri Sri Radha Landanishwara. And so once we got there, he decided he would stay in London for the rest of the day. So I got permission from him to go back to Bhaktivedanta Manor so that I could meet my parents and take them around. So I had emigrated to Australia in 1971. And then in the beginning of 72, I became a devotee. And I had a rather acrimonious exchange of letters with my parents in the initial stages of my being a devotee. They didn't know what had happened. They thought that I'd gone crazy. You know, I'd been captured by this cult, and I'd given all my money away to them. And like this, my mum was writing and saying, I'm going to get the police and have you, you know, rescued. And and I was writing back to them and I was saying, well, actually, you know, you're not really my parents. We're not this body and you're not really my parents and like this. So they didn't appreciate that. I didn't appreciate what they were saying. But we eventually came to a truce where I agreed that I wouldn't preach to them. And they wouldn't criticize the devotees. So then on 76, so this is like 4 years later, then I was coming back to England. And but now I was coming with Srila Prabhupada. So they came down to see me. Anyway, so I got permission from Prabhupada. I went back there and I arrived at the manor just when my parents were just walking through the gate. So it was nice and timely. We had a nice meeting. They were very happy. I took them around the manor. I showed them the deities. I sold them a Bhagavad Gita and explained a bit about the philosophy, and they were quite happy. Then it came time for them. Then it was mid-afternoon, about 4 o'clock. And in the temples that I had previously been in, then usually the Sunday feast prasadam was served about, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock. So I thought, well, I'll get them some prasadam. You know, Prabhupada wouldn't be happy if they came and they didn't get prasadam. But then when I inquired from the devotees, you know, where's the Sunday feast? They said, oh, there's nothing left. You know, I said, why? They said, well, we have our Sunday feast at 12 o'clock. So it's all been served out. You're too late. So I couldn't get anything for them. So I wasn't very happy about it, but nothing could be done. Then about 5:30 they were leaving because they had this long drive back. And we were stood at the gateway to the entrance of the manor. And just as we were saying goodbye, then Srila Prabhupada came back from London in this Rolls Royce, went past us. So I ran after the car and left my parents at the gate for a while. I said, I'll be back. And then Prabhupada pulled up and got out and went up to his rooms. I kind of just made sure everything was okay. And then I told him, I'm just seeing off my parents, so I'll come back. So then my parents left. They actually, because they were pressed for time, and I didn't want to immediately, you know, impinge on Srila Prabhupada, because he'd just come back from a heavy day's preaching actually in London, and I wanted him to, you know, get settled in and not make him feel that he was obliged to see my parents as soon as he came back. So I never actually asked him if, you know, he would give a darshan to them. And they had, you know, they were waiting to go, so I let them go. Then when I came back up to Prabhupada's room after bidding them farewell, Prabhupada asked me what had transpired. And he was pleased to hear that they liked everything. So they took prasadam, he asked. My face fell and I had to admit that they had not. Prabhupada's instant look of disappointment and his simple, oh, was as much to say, well, what was the use of inviting them then? He didn't actually say that, but that was the response that was conveyed. So Prabhupada was really disappointed that they come all that way and I didn't manage to give them prasadam. Later on, actually, a couple of years later, I went back to the manor and invited them. They did come again, and that second occasion I actually had the devotees cook a big feast, and I sat them down at a big table and fed them as full as they could get. So I felt then that, you know, Prabhupada would be happy with that one. So anyway, that was Prabhupada's response. You know, he heard that I'd sold them a Gita, they'd seen the deities, they'd heard the devotees chanting, but his question was, did you give him prasadam? So, because food is the center of Indian culture. In India, you go to different areas. There's Gujarati food, there's Punjabi food, there's Bengali food, there's South Indian food, all different varieties. And each region is known for their particular cuisine. And it's a whole kind of social, it's built into the social system also. You know, the giving of prasadam, or at least foodstuffs. So on August the 17th, 1976, Srila Prabhupada had flown down the evening before, ready for the opening of the temple. When we got there, Mahamsa informed him that his rooms were not ready, and that he had arranged for us instead to go to a life member's house, which was about a 45-minute drive from the temple, and it was already late at night when we arrived there. So when we first arrived, actually, they took us to the temple, and there was about a 6 or 8 brahmanas that had come up from South India, led by a man called Sampat Kumar Bhattacharya. They were like real traditional, you know, Indian brahmanas, big seekers, big bellies, big tilak, big earrings, you know, the whole works. They looked the real part. And they were very nice. And when Prabhupada arrived at the airport, then they came right up to the aeroplane. And as Prabhupada came down, then they began chanting all these different Vedic mantras to welcome him. And they escorted him into the waiting area of the airport. And then Prabhupada sat down for a few minutes and the brahmanas were all chanting. It was very, very nice. Then from there we went to the temple, and at the side of the temple they'd set up a jagyashala, or an area where there were several fire pits for doing all the pujas. And they invited Prabhupada to come in there. He sat down at the main fire, and then they chanted various mantras and did various pujas to honor Srila Prabhupada as the person who was building the temple. I forget the technical name, but it's part of the procedure, actually. So after about half an hour, then that was finished. And then Prabhupada was expecting that he would go into the temple. Then Mahamsa told him, actually, you know, your rooms are not ready, so we're going to stay at this man's house, Mr. Hari Prasad Bhadruka. So we got there, I think it was about 11 or 11.30 at night by the time we got there. Then, of course, we had to talk with Mr. Bhadruka for a while. And so it was about 1 o'clock by the time Prabhupada actually got settled down. And I took rest after giving him his massage. And then at 5 o'clock in the morning, Prabhupada rang the bell and said, actually, this is not good. We should be staying in the temple. because he was concerned, you know, whether everything was going on properly there or not. So first thing this morning, Prabhupada decided it would not be suitable to stay at Mr. Bhadruka's house. We packed and left right after bathing. We arrived at the temple at daybreak, and it gave us a chance to see the place clearly. The temple is impressive. The land was donated by Mr. G. Pullareddy, and although it is only 950 square meters, the building covers 90% of it. Its location is excellent. In the central part of the city, it is hardly 10 minutes walk from the main railway station. Srila Prabhupada's quarters are on the first floor at the back of the building. Despite the fact that work is still going on and that cement, dirt and dust are everywhere and the noise of construction is all pervasive, Srila Prabhupada moved right in. The room was so dirty that I had to sweep it out while Prabhupada sat and watched me. So the devotees didn't even get it together to clean his room before he got in. Somehow the local devotees could not arrange to have it cleaned before he came. But Prabhupada does not seem to mind. His main concern is that they organize a successful opening of the temple. Settling into his 16 feet by 12 feet room, he smiled and told us, 16 feet is about 5 meters, and 12 feet is about 4, 5 by 4 meters. Sorry, you're on the metric here. He told us, it is better to stay at one's own place than someone else's. In India, even a poor man, he may be forced to eat somewhere else, but he must have his own place to stay, otherwise all respect is lost. He can eat at some other place during every day, but he will return to his own place to take rest. He said the Indian system is so nice that even one's enemies may be treated as a guest and given everything. Then he added with a smile, although to get rid of an unwanted guest, one simply doesn't feed them. He explained that one does not eat or stay at another's place for more than 3 days in a row. Otherwise, one becomes an unwanted guest. One actually loses one's status as a guest and then becomes a resident. So 3 days, that's the limit. You can turn up and expect to get fed, but then if they don't feed you anymore, then you know they don't want you there. So later in 1976, in July, on the 10th of July, we're in New York. There was one devotee. His name was Rishi Kumar. So Rishi Kumar had been a sannyasi for a while in the early days of the movement in India. And Prabhupada was very pleased with his efforts. He said that in Bombay in 72-73, Rishi Kumar was doing Herculean tasks. So then Rishi Kumar went off to preach in South Africa. And because there was no association there, or very little, he fell in Maya, and then he gave up not just being a sannyasi, but he gave up being a devotee. So he went off back to Laguna Beach. So in 1976, when Prabhupada came to Los Angeles, Rishi Kumar, who had started coming around a little bit to the Laguna Beach temple, he came to see Srila Prabhupada. So he had, you know, fuzzy afro-style hair, and, you know, he was kind of like he was very, you know, kind of disturbed. But he came to see Prabhupada, and when Prabhupada asked him, so, why have you come? He didn't really have any reason. He just said, well, I just came to see you. So then Prabhupada looked at him and he said, I could not have dreamed that you could have become like this. He was very, very sober. And he told him now, he said, you take up your proper position as a devotee again, like this. So he preached to me for a few minutes. So then Rishi Kumar went off, and it didn't seem that, you know, there'd been any effect. But then later on, a couple of weeks later, we were in New Vrindavan. Then we got the word that Rishi Kumar came to New Vrindavan, and he was all shaved up. And he had decided to rejoin the temple, and he was going to join the New York temple. So then July, on the 9th, we got to New York and Rishi Kumar was there. And then this particular day, the 10th of July, Rishi Kumar, who had previously been a very good cook, so he had decided to take up service in the restaurant in the New York temple. It was a new building, 11 stories. The basement was a restaurant, so Rishi was working in there. So on the 10th then, he brought up Srila Prabhupada, a special preparation that he'd made for him. So Prabhupada looked at it. It was like this big savory dish. And he looked at it and he said, "What is that?" So Rishi Kumar told him, "It's called a Raj Kachuri." So everybody was laughing because we'd heard of kachuris, which are about this big. But we never heard of a Raj Kachuri, which was about this big. It looked like a pancake, but thick. Bali Mardana explained that it's stuffed with dal, potato, tamarind sauce, and sour cream. Then somebody else said, "Rishi's making up for lost time." So Prabhupada said, "Where did you learn this?" So then he said, "In Kailash Shaksharyas." So Kailash Shaksharya was actually the first person in India to host the devotees, the first batch of American devotees when they flew over in 1971. They had arrived at Bombay. They were met by this man, Mr. Shaksharya, and he had taken them to his house. About 30 devotees. They'd never been to India before. And that was the beginning of the Indian preaching. So Rishi Kumar, he had learned how to cook from Kailash Shaksharya's cook. So all the rich men in India, they are very expert, usually Marwari cooks. And they're very, very expert. They can cook thousands of preparations and perfectly. So Rishi said that he learned from Kailash Shaksharya's cook. He said, "At least I learned something there." So Prabhupada said, "Yes, that cookie is very expert." And then he went on to talk about Indian cooking. So he said, "In India, a girl, if she can cook nicely, then she is perfect. There is a ceremony, it is called Bahubat. So after marriage, the girl comes to her father-in-law's house, and there is this ceremony called Bahubat. In that Bahubat, the girl is to cook and then distribute the food to all of her relatives of her husband. If they say it is excellent, then she is accepted into the family." Bali Mardan said, "Well, what if they say it's not excellent?" Prabhupada replied, "Nobody says." But the ceremony is made. The social system in India is, if I do not accept your food, then I do not take you within my inner circle. You remain outside. Tamal Krishna added that it's a great offense if you offer someone prasadam and they refuse. Prabhupada said, "Yes, that means that I am not accepting you as intimate. And if he accepts, then you cannot deny his friendship." About 100 years ago in Bengal, in the aristocratic circle, the guests were invited and then very sumptuously food is distributed. And then the gentlemen, the guests, they will come and they will see only, and they will simply say, "Oh, it is very nicely done." They'll not eat, and they'll go away, and then the foodstuff will be distributed to the servants. So this was the aristocracy. They will not eat, but they will simply see and appreciate. "Oh, you have so many varieties, very nice." And then they'll go. And then the household servants and the others, then they'll eat it. Tamal Krishna asked, "Why didn't they eat it?" And Prabhupada said, "That was the custom." But they would just eat by looking, that's all. Appreciate, that's very nice. And away they'll go. But this was actually a factor in the early days of our movement, that when we set up our temple in Vrindavan especially, then there was a lot of resistance to the Western Vaishnavas. And a lot of the local temple leaders, they would not recognize Prabhupada's disciples as genuine Vaishnavas. So when we had festivals, and it's customary you invite all the leaders of the different sampradayas or babajis or temples, then everybody comes, and then everybody, you know, it's traditional, you serve out the Vaishnavas. So some of them wouldn't come, and even if they did come, when it came to the point when the prasadam was distributed, then they would all excuse themselves and go back home. So it was actually an insult, because it meant that they were not accepting that this is actually prasadam. This has been touched by the malachas, and therefore it's not fit to be eaten. So out of some, you know, respect for Prabhupada, they may come, but then they wouldn't eat. Then later on, then Vishvambhar Goswami, who was in charge of the Radharaman temple and was an old friend of Srila Prabhupada's, then he came and he began to accept the prasadam, because he appreciated the work that Prabhupada was doing, and he understood actually the philosophy that, you know, a Vaishnava is beyond bodily designation. And Prabhupada was preaching very strongly and criticizing them for not understanding, you know, the difference between the soul and the body. So then Vishvambhar Goswami started, and once he started, then all the others followed suit, because he was practically the leader of the Vaishnav community in Vrindavan at that time. He had been the mayor of Vrindavan, and he was very, very, very well respected, and he was in charge of one of the oldest temples in Vrindavan. So then as soon as he kind of broke the ice, then everybody else said, oh, okay, Vishvambhar Goswami is having, so we shall take now as well. So this is all etiquette. If you offer food and somebody doesn't accept it, it means that they don't want to be intimately connected. If they do accept it, then it becomes you know, a whole another level of reciprocation and friendship. So that's a little bit about Indian culture. Now we'll go on to another topic about not eating food offered or cooked by non-devotees. So in 1976 we were in Vrindavan in April, and on the 6th of April a letter came from Purudas in Los Angeles. He had sent it several months before to Prabhupada's secretary, and then somehow or another it didn't catch up with us until April. So Puru was concerned about the temple in Los Angeles, excuse me, purchasing sour cream that was known to have rennet, which was an extract from the stomach lining of a calf, and in another batch that had got gelatin in it. So the rationale used was that almost everything in Kali Yuga is contaminated. And Prabhupada had previously allowed the use of white sugar, which is bleached over animal bones. He had also allowed the purchase of milk that had fish liver oil added to it. A further motivation for the purchase was the very cheap price of 5 cents per pound. Therefore, the GBC, Jai Tirtha, had consented to the purchase of the sour cream because the amount of rennet that was in it was very small, about 1 cc per 150 gallons, or 1/50,000th of an ounce per pint. Very minute amount. Still, despite the seemingly insignificant quantity, some devotees were disturbed by its use, and thus Puru requested a direct statement from Prabhupada to settle the matter. It seems to me, although I am a fallen, fault-finding rascal, that only Srila Prabhupada can say whether or not this sour cream is offerable to the deity and can be used. I certainly do not know. There are valid arguments on both sides, but the only real point is whether or not Krishna is pleased with such offerings, and only the pure devotee can tell us that. He added as a postscript that the temple has over 400 pounds of it in the refrigerator, and some had reasoned that Prabhupada would not want to see the sour cream wasted. Puru wanted to know if they should use it up, never buy it again, dump it, or continue to use it and not be agitated by the contents. Prabhupada's reply was short and clear. Concerning the use of sour cream in the temple, it should be stopped immediately. Nothing can be offered to the deities which is purchased in the stores. Things produced by the karmis should not be offered to Radha and Krishna. Sour cream, if you can prepare it, it is okay, but not otherwise. Now, you have such a big stock of this sour cream, so sell that stock at any cost. Who is the rascal who has purchased without permission? So anything which is prepared by the karmis, you cannot offer that to the deities. If the devotees prepare it, it can be offered, but not if it's prepared by karmis. So another, because that was sour cream, another thing that was coming into fashion sometimes was devotees were offering frozen foods. So on August the 2nd, 1976, we were in New Mayapur in France. I was giving Prabhupada his massage in the evening. So as he lay in the half light, I mentioned that I had heard that some of the temples were using frozen foods for their deity offerings. Prabhupada shook his head and gave a sour look. Tamasic food, tamasic activities. It is going on simply by Krishna's mercy. So, short and sweet. It's all in Tamagun. So then later on, 1 week later, we were in Tehran. We'd gone from France. We landed in Iran. And then I heard that the devotees there were taking vegetables and then preserving them by freezing them and keeping them in a deep freeze, because during the winter time it was difficult to get vegetables. So then I was kind of a bit doubtful whether that was okay, because Prabhupada had made this comment the week before in France. So then I told Nandarani what Prabhupada had said and suggested that she get Prabhupada, you know, to give his opinion. So Srila Prabhupada came down into the kitchen today to talk with Nandarani about her efforts to conserve vegetables by bottling and freezing them. I had expressed concern to her when I heard that she was doing this because of what Prabhupada said in France about the frozen foods being tamasic. She explained to him that in winter no vegetables whatsoever are available. So he consented, once again demonstrating his willingness to adjust devotional activity according to time, place and circumstance. So on the one hand he condemned it, and then on the other hand he gave permission, depending on the circumstances. Then later on there was another discussion that we had in November with Hansa Duda Swami, and this topic came up again. So this was on November the 3rd in Vrindavan. Hansa Duda Swami has been several times to Moscow to visit with Ananta Shanti Prabhu, Prabhupada's only Russian disciple. And he and Prabhupada shared some observations and realizations about the poor quality of life there. Ananta Shanti's entire family live in a couple of rooms half the size of Prabhupada's darshan room. And Prabhupada recalled how the taxi drivers were begging for extra money from their clients, and the only vegetables available were frozen. Prabhupada screwed his face a little in disgust. That also is nasty. Frozen means nasty. I never take frozen. In the beginning I thought, oh, it is very nice, you can get fresh vegetable. But they are not at all fresh, all rotten. Rather, the same vegetable, as we have got in Indian practice, then we dry it and keep it. That is tasteful. In the season time, suppose that in the season there is a huge quantity of vegetables. So the system is that they cut it into pieces during the season and they dry it in the sun and then keep it. And during the out of season, it is then soaked in water, it revives the old taste, and then you can cook it. So freezing actually doesn't do anything, it still goes rotten. And everybody knows as soon as you unfreeze it, within a few minutes or hours, the whole thing is completely rotten, unless you cook it straight away. But with dried food, it's completely different. You dry it in the sun, it gets all the vitamins from the sunshine, it's dried out, it preserves it very nicely, then you can just revive it with a little water and then cook it, and it's very healthy. So speaking of vegetables made him reflect once again on the glories of a simple rural life, devoid of grand material endeavor. This I want to introduce, he said. Let them be satisfied with whatever they can produce themselves locally. What is that? A little cloth, a little food. Any man can produce these things. There is no difficulty at all. They must agree to this simple life. Everywhere you can produce your own food and cloth and a cottage. If possible, you can construct big buildings, but there is no need. And they should be satisfied, happy with Krishna. Then life is successful. This I want to introduce now, everywhere. And it is practical. It is not something bogus. We have already experimented, and by God's grace, we can produce everything from the land. Sava kama duga mahi. You can get everything. And if they are satisfied with this simple life, then they will save time for Krishna consciousness and a happy life. So that was Prabhupada's program. At that time, there was a big push in most yatras to buy land and then set up these rural communities. And Prabhupada said four things. If you can produce yourself, then you can be self-sufficient. Produce your own food, make your own cloth, build your own houses, and grow your own medicines, herbs. And then if you have those four things, then you can live very simply, but very nicely, and then have the time spare for becoming Krishna conscious. So that's a little bit about frozen food and non-devotee food. Now a bit about meat eating and meat eaters. So September the 29th, 1976, we were in Vrindavan. And there were problems with the Vrindavan management at that time. Akayananda Swami had been in charge since the opening. He was like the co-temple president. But somehow or another, whenever Prabhupada came, he was never satisfied with the management. There was always so many things that were not being done properly. The deity worship was not up to the proper standard. The flowers were not up to the proper standard. The foodstuffs that they were cooking and distributing in the restaurant was not up to standard. The guest house that Prabhupada had spent lakhs and lakhs of rupees, 25 lakhs of rupees to build, was half empty, practically speaking, and the rest of the rooms were occupied by devotees and not by paying guests. So Prabhupada was not happy about this state of affairs, and so he made an experiment. And he asked Hansaduda Swami to become the temple president there, and he made Akayananda Swami his personal secretary. So then he was having conversations with Hansaduda in the back garden of his quarters in Vrindavan there, and telling him what he wanted for the temple management. So a little later in the conversation, Hansaduda offered to print books in India, and although Prabhupada confirmed that is his main concern, to get huge quantities of his books printed in Hindi and English, he told Hansaduta to simply concentrate on the guest house for now. He spoke at length, saying that having a guest house was actually his Guru Maharaj's idea. I am just following the desire of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He chuckled as he spoke about his spiritual master's strong desire to preach and spread Krishna consciousness. He said that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta had so stressed the importance of having people come to the temple, and of course that was the reason why he combined a guest house with a temple. You know, they seem incongruous in one sense, that what would a temple have to do with a hotel? But the idea, and it was a plan of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta's, that people don't normally come to a temple, but if there's a nice guest house or hotel, they may come stay there, and then they'll automatically, you know, be in close proximity to the temple, and they'll go in and they'll get some benefit. So this was the idea. So Bhaktisiddhanta has so stressed the importance of having people come to the temple that he said even if they have to be served meat, by any means they should be induced to come and hear about Krishna. Hansaduta and I were quite amazed to hear this. We must have looked a little shocked, because Prabhupada immediately reassured us, we will never serve meat. But the idea is that if the visitors feel too much inconvenience from our rules, then an arrangement can be made, maybe for tea or coffee, or even this betel or bidi. Not exactly in the guest house, but some kind of shop in the front of the Gurukul building, where they can get these things. And we can even bring them tea into the guest house if need be. But we want that people will come. We want to give them the opportunity for spiritual life. And therefore we have a temple and a guest house combined. We left the garden appreciating once again how Srila Prabhupada has inherited the revolutionary mantle of his Guru Maharaj. He is prepared to go to practically any length to induce people to take to Krishna consciousness. So then there was another occasion when meat became an issue. This involved Harikesh Maharaj. On January the 3rd, 1976, when he was still a brahmachari, he was Prabhupada's cook. I'd just joined the party about a month before. We'd gone to South India, and we were to visit a city called Nellore, which is about 3 hours on the train north of Madras. And there were two sisters there, the Katamanchi sisters, and they had a big estate which they were offering to give to ISKCON. So they had 7 acres, which is about 3 hectares, one plot, which was just a bare land. And then next to that, they had a 1 hectare plot, which had their house on it, and it was cultivated. So the plan was that they were going to give the 3 hectares immediately, and Prabhupada was going there to install the foundation stone. And we were staying on the other plot, and that plot would be given to ISKCON when the sisters died. So that was supposed to be written into their will. Anyway, later on that we discovered that there were some problems with this so-called gift. And Prabhupada, in the end, figured out that actually it was a plot to get ISKCON to come in and put some buildings up, and then by some legal maneuverings have it taken back off us again and have it given to some other group. Anyway, we didn't know that when we first arrived, but what happened was that when we first arrived, the two sisters on January 3rd, the two sisters' reception of Srila Prabhupada was cordial, but there was a distinct coolness in their temperament which we all noticed. They gave him a small but pleasant room with a grilled-in veranda. We servants were shown a room directly above him on the roof, so Prabhupada immediately got ready for his massage. As we sat on the veranda and I began to apply the oil to his head, we heard a familiar clucking noise across the pathway. "What is that?" Prabhupada asked. I looked out through the grilled window and I saw a hen coop. "It's chickens," Srila Prabhupada. "Oh, then that means..." "Well, it means that at least they're eating eggs," I said, trying to be optimistic. "Call Harikesh." Harikesh came in, visibly disturbed. "Srila Prabhupada, these people are meat eaters." "Oh, then you must cook separately," he said. "You cannot cook in their kitchen. Do not use any of their pots or utensils." So that was it. We had to make a separate arrangement. And we had to kind of just tolerate being there in this house of meat eaters because they were apparently giving us this land. And later on we discovered that there were some clauses in the deed of gift which Prabhupada figured out then, you know, it was just a plan to get us to come in and build, and then just when we were, before we complete the buildings, then have it taken off us and given to this other society. So he actually... although he had installed the foundation stone, he went ahead with the ceremony. It was then afterwards that we found out about these conditions. And then he told Mahamsa, now you have to talk with them and tell them that they have to just give the land without any conditions. And then we'll build the temple. But they refused to do that. And so a month later, Prabhupada had Mahamsa go back there and dig up the foundation stone and take it to Madras. So we never actually built that temple. So anyway, the point was about the meat. So I think in Hyderabad, at the temple opening there, then Harikesh was there as Prabhupada's secretary in August. So during the conversation, then some talk was made about the preaching Eastern Europe. And then Harikesh began to tell Srila Prabhupada how difficult it was just to get foodstuffs. And Prabhupada was suggesting that devotees go and they stay there. And at that point they were kind of going in for a couple of weeks and coming out. They're going to Hungary and Poland, and they had plans for Romania and Bulgaria and these places. But they couldn't stay there very long. You know, the visa problems were there. And also, you know, Hari Krishna was saying, well, there's this problem getting good foodstuffs. You can hardly get, you know, decent vegetables or anything. So as when he started telling Prabhupada this, then Prabhupada said, you can eat meat. So Hari Krishna kind of did a double take, but he pretended that he didn't hear what Prabhupada had just said. So he kept on talking. And again, after about a minute, Prabhupada said, you can eat meat. So then Hari Krishna stopped and he said, but Prabhupada, what about my consciousness? Prabhupada said, damn your consciousness. He said, you have to preach. So he was, you know, prepared, if there was nothing else, but the preaching had to go on in communist Eastern Europe. He was very determined. Of course, they found ways and means so that they didn't have to eat meat, but again, that, you know, mentality was there, that in extreme circumstances, Prabhupada was prepared to do anything to spread Krishna consciousness. So, something about another kind of meat, fish eating. August the 22nd, we were in Hyderabad. Mahamsa had a further concern about some young girls that were attending the temple. They were unmarried. These girls wanted, and they were coming regularly every day, and they were doing service. They wanted to get initiation from Srila Prabhupada. Actually, what happened is that their mother stopped them because she said that they were too young. They were about 13 or 14. But in India, girls normally get married around 14, 15 years old, at least in the villages. Now in the cities it's different. But that was, you know, the general system then. So Mahamsa was concerned that they're young and unmarried, and he said that they may end up marrying men who are not devotees. But Prabhupada was not they were discussing about them being initiated. But Prabhupada was not concerned. But she can chant and observe the rules and regulations. What is that? Oh, even if her husband doesn't follow, Mahamsa asked. That doesn't matter, Prabhupada said. It is individual. My sister, when she was married, her father-in-law's house, they were all eating fish. So a new girl, 10 years old, 11 years old, so she was given this foodstuff with fish and everything. So she was crying. So then a mother-in-law asked, why are you crying? No, we do not touch all these things. Because she was from a Vaishnava family, they never had meat. So she immediately arranged special cooking for her. So her husband and the other members, they were all taking fish. But she never touched. She never touched. She does not know what is fish. So if one wants to keep oneself pure, then he or she can keep herself pure in any circumstances. And actually, as far as Bhavatarini, who was Prabhupada's sister, we used to call her Pishima. Pishima is Bengali for auntie. Yeah, so it's like Prabhupada was our father, so she was our auntie because she was Prabhupada's sister. She was also initiated by, first initiation by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. So she was actually Prabhupada's material sister and spiritual sister. And then she took second initiation from one of Prabhupada's godbrothers. So her whole life, she very strictly followed. But her husband, he was a drunkard, he was a meat eater, and, you know, he was a regular debauchee. And sometimes Pishima or Bhavatarini, she would come crying to Srila Prabhupada, you know, because he was elder brother. And he would advise her, no, you stay with your husband. And he gave her his small set of deities that he had worshipped as a child, his Radha Govinda deities. And he told her, you just worship Radha Govinda and you keep your attention on them. And then, you know, gradually everything will be adjusted. So apparently when they got into their 50s, many, many years later, then Pishima's husband actually had a complete change of heart. He had some kind of like major life crisis. And then he became very, very sorry about the way that he behaved. And he stopped drinking, he stopped eating meat, and he practically worshipped his wife because she had strictly followed the principles all the time. And then he realized what an exalted soul that he was living with. So he had a complete change of heart just by her association, but it took many, many years before that occurred. So, anyway, the point that Prabhupada was making there was, even if you're in unfortunate circumstances, you can still keep the principles, as he did when he went to America. You know, he was living in the Bowery, he was living in this loft with these young men that were, you know, taking LSD and so many things, and they were keeping meat in the same refrigerator where Prabhupada had to keep his bhoga as well. You know, the meat was on one shelf, Prabhupada's stuff was on the other. But he had no choice, so he had to do it. But it didn't affect him, that's the point. So then, a little something about other non-devotional foods. In 1977, we were in Mayapur, and the ladies there, they were cooking so many different preparations for Srila Prabhupada every day. His cook was cooking, but then every day there would be this big wooden platter that would be brought up by the Bengali ladies, and it would have maybe 30 or 40 different preparations on it in little clay cups. Then Prabhupada would choose which ones he wanted. The ladies were very nice. They were very shy. They were so shy that they wouldn't even come inside the room. They would just sit at the doorway and look through the door, and Prabhupada would see what there was, what they'd cooked for him that day, and then he would take them, and then he would praise them, you know, and then they'd be very happy and they'd go off. So one day he was eating this preparation, and he said, "Oh, tree goat." And I said, "What's that, Srila Prabhupada?" He said, "Tree goat." And then he laughed. I said, "What is tree goat?" So he showed me. He said, "This is," he said, "this is a vegetable." Now, what is it? Jackfruit. He said, "So the jackfruit," he said, "before it becomes ripe," normally it's a fruit, "but before it becomes ripe," he said, "you can cut it up and then you can cook it as a vegetable." And he said, "They say," he said, "of course I do not know," but he said, "they say that it tastes exactly like the flesh of a goat." So he said, "In Bengal they call it tree goat." Right? A goat that grows on the trees. So that's another kind of, actually it's not meat, but you know, it has the same taste. And there was another occasion when we were in Los Angeles. Let me just see if I can find this. I haven't got it written down here. Another simulated taste of meat was if you cook urd dal, then we were in Los Angeles, and one of the devotees, she'd made some cauliflower pakoras, and when we ate them, Pushta Krishna refused to eat them because he said they tasted exactly like fish. So he said, even if it is cauliflower, I'm not going to eat it because the taste reminds me of fish. So I told Prabhupada about that later on, and Prabhupada laughed. And then he told us the story about his Guru Maharaj, that in Bengal, because people are so addicted to eating fish, they can't give it up. So the substitute flavor is this urd dal. So Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati used to say that if somebody is not eating urd dal, then he must be eating fish in secret. Because the flavor is so addictive that, you know, he knew if they don't take urd dal, then there's no way they can give the taste up. So they must be eating this fish in secret. So other things, non-devotee foods. We were in Aligarh, October the 9th, 1976. Prabhupada was staying at the house of a man called Surendra Kumar Saigal. He was the owner of a big company called Tiger Lock Company. So all these brass locks, then they were manufacturing that, selling all over India. So we'd gone there for a two-day pandal program that was to be held on the grounds of this man's house. So since Mr. Saigal had made some suggestions to Srila Prabhupada for helping with his health, I asked him if he could get some Greta Kumari, or aloe vera as it is known in the West. Two devotees, Arjuna and Tamalpaha Prabhus from America, had come to Vrindavan previously and suggested it as a good remedy for high blood pressure and for cleaning the arteries. I think aloe vera practically everybody knows, yeah? Yeah. So Mr. Saigal happily informed us that he had it growing in his garden. His wife takes it regularly by stuffing it into chapatis or parathas, and she finds it quite efficacious for relieving pains in her knees. Mr. Seigel, though, suggested that garlic was the best for relieving high blood pressure. Prabhupada wrinkled his nose and he grimaced slightly. Garlic. Mr. Seigel smiled at his reaction. Garlic. You don't want it. And then they laughed together. Garlic, onions, prohibited, Prabhupada told him. So it was settled that his wife would cook aloe vera chapatis for breakfast. Prabhupada asked Gaurasundara Prabhu if he knew of it, and he confirmed that they had it in Hawaii. He added that it can be used externally for skin diseases, burns and cuts. As Mr. Seigel left Prabhupada's room to prepare breakfast, Prabhupada concluded, "The body is simply troublesome." So anyway, even a smell of onions, Prabhupada wouldn't accept. We were in Bombay in December of 76. This was around about the 24th or 25th. And there was one man there, Mr. P.L. Seti. So he was a builder by trade, and he was a Punjabi. And he had a place in Chandigarh that we had stayed in when Prabhupada did a program there in October. And he had been associated with the devotees and with Prabhupada since 1972, I think, when Prabhupada first got the land, Hare Krishna land, in Juhu Beach in Bombay. And when we had first moved onto that land, there was actually no place for the devotees to stay, even though there were 6 two-story apartment buildings. But none of the apartments were empty. They were all occupied by tenants. And although Prabhupada bought the land, he was not able to remove the tenants because they had leases. So we had to wait until the leases ran out one by one and then pay them some money not to renew it and then, you know, encourage them to leave and vacate. So what Prabhupada did was he had an extra floor built on the top of each building. And in that way then our devotees had somewhere to stay. And Prabhupada had his own quarters on the top of one of the buildings at the back. So Mr. Seti was the person who did all of that building. And that's how he came to know the devotees. And he became very, very fond of Srila Prabhupada. And he regarded Prabhupada as his guru. He's still alive now even. I think now he's like about 93 or something. Very old. But he's still, every year, he goes to Vrindavan. And on one particular day, they have a special offering that they do at the Bunki Bihari temple, which is said to be the most popular temple in Vrindavan. And he does this whole puja, very elaborate, for a half a day it takes. Costs a huge amount of money, but he does it all in the honor of Srila Prabhupada. So it's very nice. Anyway, so Mr. Seti, he played a very important role at Hare Krishna Land. He built these extra floors. Then when the devotees got the deities, they had this big pandal at Cross Maidan. And the deities of Radharas Bihari were actually installed at the pandal. And then after the pandal, this was in 71 it was actually, yeah. After the pandal, then Prabhupada had a temporary shelter, which was constructed on Hare Krishna land. And he had Radharas Bihari installed in that temporary shelter. And then the plan was to build a big, big temple. So there was a lot of fighting going on with the person that owned the land, because the deal to buy the land had not yet been completed before Prabhupada moved on. What had happened, he put a big deposit down, and then he immediately ordered the devotees to move on to the land. Then he had the deities installed on the land, even before we owned it. So the man that was selling the land, Mr. Nair, he'd formerly been the mayor of Bombay, he was a big man, and he was a swindler. So he was thinking that, you know, he'll get the deposit from Srila Prabhupada and then somehow or another he'll trick him out of, you know, paying the balance and then he'll resell the land to somebody else and not give the deposit back. And we were told that actually he actually was planning to sell the land to three different people. So he was a trickster. But and he was thinking, you know, this man's a sadhu, simple person. So it'd be easy. He's got so many Western followers. He has money. I'll take his deposit and then I'll, you know, get rid of him. But he didn't know who he was dealing with. Prabhupada was an expert businessman, of course, from his previous life before he took sannyas, and he was fighting for Krishna. And when Prabhupada understood that this man was a cheater, then he became very determined that he was going to defeat him and get that land for Krishna. And he told us, actually, he said that, "I went to Radharasa Bihari and I prayed that, my dear sir, now I brought you here, so you kindly sit here, and I promise you I'll build you a big temple, a wonderful temple, if you just stay here and don't move." So then he said later on, he said, "I see that he actually did that." So anyway, what happened was that this man instigated the local municipality to bring a police contingent to evict us from the land. So we had this temporary temple. It might have been a bit about the same size as this, actually. But it was like, you know, there was a brick part of it where the deities were in, and there was a kitchen behind. There was a tin roof over the top. Then there was a concrete platform out the front of that for darshan area. And there was just a simple tin roof with steel poles holding it up. That was it. It was all open air. That was the temple. So there was some fighting going on in the court with this man. He was trying to get rid of us. We weren't going. Prabhupada, you know, wasn't going to leave. And so what this man did was, he had one of the Bombay councillors, I think his name was Maitra or something, Maitre. So he sent a whole squad of police officers along with a demolition crew, and they came onto Hare Krishna land on Sunday morning. And they started to wreck the temple. They started to demolish it with Radharasa Bihari in it. I mean, you could kind of imagine it might happen in the Western country, but to happen in India, it was outrageous. So they brought oxyacetylene torches. They started burning down all the, through the steel poles and ripping down the roof. And the devotees were fighting them. And the police arrested all the devotees and put them in wagons to take them away to the jailhouse. So one devotee, Manasvi, he ran out, and he knew a man who was in a political party in opposition to the councillor. So he rang this man up, he's the head of the Shiv Sena party, they're like fanatic Hindus. So he rang him up, and he said, "You know, these men are here, they're demolishing Krishna's temple." So he said, "Don't worry, I'll stop it immediately." So he rang up his friends. And then another squad of police came. And then they had an order from the court. He had a judge issue an emergency order, a stay order, to stop the demolition. So they came on and they said, "Now we have a stay order, you have to stop." So they were just on the roof of the deity room, peeling off the tin, right above Radharasa Bihari, and then they had to stop in the nick of time. So then everybody cleared out. So then in the evening, Mr. Sethi, who didn't know what had been going on, he came for the evening program, and he sees the temple's all, you know, broken and like, and so he asked Giriraj, he was the temple president, what was going on, and then he explained the whole thing. And Giriraj said, "What will happen is that first thing in the morning, this will go to the court, and then the likely thing is the court will issue a status quo order, which means however everything is at that moment, then that status quo will freeze it until the matter can be finally decided at a later date." So he said, "If we don't have a temple functioning tomorrow morning, we won't be able to do anything after this order is issued. So we've only got tonight to rebuild the temple. And, you know, it's Sunday. Nobody's working, and there's no laborers. What can we do?" So Mr. Sethi said, "Don't worry." He said, I will rebuild the temple tonight. By Mangal Aarti tomorrow, it will be like it was before." So he called up his sons, and he ran around. He got the materials from here and there. He brought some laborers, and then about 9 o'clock at night, it was pouring with rain, they started work. So then about an hour later, a bunch of guys came, maybe 5 or 10, and they were all these local gundas, thugs, that had been hired by the other party. So they came and they threatened him that if you lay one brick, we'll kill you. And this is not an idle threat. In India, they do it. You know, they have all the, you know, machetes and homemade revolvers and things like this. They said, we'll bring 150 men and we'll, you know, wreck the place and we'll kill you. So Mr. Sethi and his son, they pulled out their revolvers. They had guns. They pulled them out. They said, fine, you bring them. We have 200 bullets and we'll kill every one of you. So then these men went off and they never came back. So he said all night long they were on watch, but they were building in the rain. And he said, I was thinking about the story of Krishna lifting the Gava downhill. Yeah, that Indra was throwing so much rain, but still Krishna was able to give shelter, you know, to the inhabitants of Vrindavan. So he said, I was thinking, okay, Indra, you do your worst, but I'm going to build Krishna's temple before Mangalati tomorrow. So in this way, they worked through the whole night, and by Mangalati, they had the temple, you know, fixed up and ready. And then, sure enough, first thing in the morning at the court, the issue was issued, stay order, status quo, and everything was frozen. So he did it. Anyway, so you can imagine how pleased Srila Prabhupada was with this man. You know, he'd done this amazing work. They came there, risked their lives. They had their guns and everything. And when we actually, later on in 76, when we were at Mr. Sethi's house in Chandigarh, Prabhupada had gone there to have a 5-day pandal. And Mr. Sethi had let us use his house as a temporary ISKCON temple. So we were staying there. And Prabhupada, one afternoon in the darshan, he was telling us about Mr. Sethi. And he said, Sethi, he said he's a Punjabi. The Punjabis are Kshatriyas. And then he told us a story about Mr. Sethi's background. And he said that in 1947, when the partition of India occurred, when, you know, they got independence, but they partitioned West Pakistan and East Pakistan. And all the Hindus that were in Pakistan came over the border into India, and all the Muslims that were in northern India went over the border into Pakistan because they were all afraid what was going to happen. And actually what happened was that there were massive riots, and something like between 500,000 and 1 million people were killed within a few days at the border crossings. So it was havoc. And the partition was right across Punjab. So Mr. Sethi was in the living in the, you know, the area where all the action was taking place. So they took to walking around with swords because they were, you know, they were Punjabis. They were from a Kshatriya class. So they were walking around with swords. Prabhupada was telling us this story. And he said that he was walking along and then a carriage came up and 4 or 5 Muslims jumped off and they came running towards him to attack him, you know, with knives. So Mr. Sethi, he whipped out his sword and with one swipe, he chopped the head off the guy in front, and his head flew off into a ditch and the body kept on running down the road and then also toppled over and fell into a ditch. So Prabhupada was telling us this and we were all, wow. And then Prabhupada said, yes. He said, this is Kshatriya. So, anyway, you know, Prabhupada had a lot of appreciation for Mr. Sethi. Now, where does this lead us to in terms of prasadam? So, Prabhupada was there in Bombay, like 2 months after he told us this story, and Mr. Sethi came at breakfast time, and his wife had made this preparation. I don't know whether it was some kind of rice thing, or I can't exactly, utma or something. But anyway, he brought this preparation that his wife had made, and Prabhupada had already sat down to eat. So Mr. Sethi gave me the preparation, and he said, we made this for Prabhupada, please give it to him for his breakfast. So then I took it in, and I put it down, And then Prabhupada said, "What's that smell?" So then I said, "Well, you know, I kind of smelt the preparation." I said, "It smells like onions." So Prabhupada said, "Go and ask him." So I went out and I asked Mr. Sethi. I said, "You know, that preparation, it smells like onions. I said, you know, did you use onions when you were cooking?" He said, "No, no." He said, "We know very well." He said, "We use onions for ourselves. But," he said, "when we cook for Prabhupada," he said, "we never use onions or anything. We know, you know, what the standard is." And he said, "My wife always, you know, cooks for something for his breakfast." So then I went in and I told him what Mr. Sethi had said. But just because it smelt like onions, Prabhupada refused to eat it, sent it back out. Mr. Sethi was really disappointed. But Prabhupada wouldn't touch it just because it smelt like onions. So he wasn't going to take the risk. Maybe it had been cooked in a pot with onions, I don't know. That had been used for cooking onions. But anyway, that's how strict Srila Prabhupada was. So another item that came up in November of 1976, November the 25th, we were in Vrindavan there. And in the evening, we'd been in Vrindavan about 3 months by that time. And there was this devotee, Mahavir Prabhu, who had been preaching in Brazil. Then he left Brazil and came to India to do some service. And he arrived about November the 10th in Vrindavan. As soon as he arrived, Prabhupada immediately made him the temple manager because he knew him somewhat from before. So by the 25th of November, what he had done was he had set up a snack bar. He was trying to kind of spruce things up and liven things up a bit. So at the front gate, nowadays that's where Prabhupada's samadhi is. But in those days, of course, the samadhi wasn't there. It was open land. And there was a well on one side. When you came in through the gate facing the temple, it was on the right. So next to the well, he made like a snack bar. And he put some seats and, you know, the devotees would gather in the evenings. So I went up to the front gate tonight to check out the fare at the new snack bar that Mahavir Prabhu has set up. Situated just inside and to the right of the front entrance as you enter the property, it sells French fries, lassi, kachuris, and other small snacks. With three picnic tables provided, it has quickly become a social spot for the devotees, especially after the evening arati. Now the weather is getting colder, and there are a few that like to gather, have a fried snack, a hot drink, and a chat. When I walked up, the first thing that I saw was a small sign on the counter advertising hot drinking chocolate. "Hey, Maha, that's not bona fide," I called to Mahavir Prabhu. "What's not bona fide?" Mahavir responded, looking concerned. "The hot drinking chocolate. You can't serve chocolate." "No, hot drinking chocolate is different. It's okay. Prabhupada said it's okay." "Did you ask him?" I asked him suspiciously. "Well, no, but drinking chocolate isn't the same as regular chocolate." "Of course it is. It's chocolate. How can it be any different?" "Well, how do you know that chocolate isn't bona fide?" "Well, I first heard when I joined that you can't offer chocolate. It's like coffee. It's got caffeine." "No, I don't think it does. I heard it's okay." So in this way, we debated for several minutes. He wasn't willing to concede, and I could see that several others who were gathered there also thought that hot drinking chocolate was a good idea. Then I said, "Well, let's go and ask Srila Prabhupada." So he agreed that it was a good idea and it would settle the matter clearly. So we went into Prabhupada's darshan room, where he was sitting quietly, chanting almost inaudibly on his beads. "What is that?" Prabhupada asked pleasantly, as we offered our obeisances and sat before him. "Well, the devotees are selling hot drinking chocolate at the new snack bar, Srila Prabhupada," I said. "And I don't think that it's bona fide, but Mahavir Prabhu thinks that it is. So we thought that we should ask you." "So what is it made from?" Prabhupada asked thoughtfully. Mahavir raced back up to the shop and brought the can. He read out the ingredients. "It's mainly from cocoa, this cocoa bean," Prabhupada. "Oh, cocoa. Well, then that is that cocoa bean? It comes from that?" "Yes, Srila Prabhupada." oh, then it is not all right. If it is from the coca bean, then you cannot take. That means caffeine. So that was it. The issue was settled, and hot drinking chocolate is no longer on the menu. So sometimes these things are controversial, especially things like chocolate, because everybody likes it so much. Very difficult to give it up. And actually, I heard that in Europe, all except Swiss chocolate, by law, there's some ingredient that's derived from cow's blood that is used in the chocolate to preserve it. And by law, they have to put it in. So only Swiss chocolate. But anyway, no chocolate because it comes from this cacao bean. So, another topic. Anybody have any questions up to this point?
And the white chocolate. White chocolate.
White chocolate. If it's made from the coca bean, then you can't take it.
It has cocoa butter.
Yeah, I don't know what cocoa butter is. You'd have to look in the ingredients. Somebody told me later on that actually cocoa doesn't have actually caffeine in it. Or maybe like a minute quantity, but it does have another stimulant in it that's actually worse than caffeine. So, you know, whether you take it, it's caffeine or not, but it has this stimulant in it, and that's why people are addicted to chocolate. It's very difficult to give up chocolate once you start, you know, because it's got these ingredients and it gives you a bit of a boost. So, any other questions? Yes.
About this chocolate, we use carob instead.
Yeah. So carob is okay. It's a completely different thing. That's the substitute, normally. And of course, you know, in India you have laddu and all these things. You can make them taste very similar. Okay, so eating with non-devotees. This is another aspect. Not just what you eat, but who you eat with. Yeah.
There is one question, if you can.
Yeah.
Koji žive na otocima, koji žive od ribolova, kojima je ribolov nema način ono egzistencija, znači ili da se bave ribolovom ili da ono kao idu negdje drugi živi.
This is concerned about people who live on the island.
Yeah, you can speak, go away.
Yeah.
Because they don't have many choice, they mainly eat fish.
Znači, smo odnos tih ljudi kojima je ribolov egzistencijalna
potreba
i ljudi koji žive u gradu, koji jedu
like
meso, ne znam, sve i sve što je i odnos recimo jednih drugih ljudi
u ljudi.
A kao ćeš reći, koja je njihova opcija ako moraju jesti ribu?
Njima je život loviti ribu.
Economically, economically as well as, I think, as very economically as well, they depend on fishing.
Yeah, it's difficult. Actually, nowadays, there's no excuses. Anybody can be a vegetarian unless you're living on the North Pole, you know. If you're an Eskimo, maybe, then you have to eat fish. But nowadays, the way that the world economy is and, you know, the trade that's going on, there's no excuses. If you want to be a vegetarian, you can be a vegetarian. You know, it's very easy. Maybe, 100 years ago or something, it might have been difficult. But apart from that, you know, if you're earning your livelihood in that way, then what can be done? There's actually, there was one devotee, his name was Vasudev Das. He was in charge in Fiji. So before he was initiated, then he had invited Srila Prabhupada to come to Fiji Island, and they decided to build a temple and set up ISKCON there. And they put a lot of money into this temple, hundreds of thousands of dollars. His name was Dayoji Punja. So he was, they're practically the richest family in Fiji, the Punjas. And they have a lot of business enterprises, but the main one that they had was that they had the biggest and practically the only supermarket on the island. So in the supermarket, because it was a family business, that wasn't just Dayoji, there was him and I think three or four brothers that all owned the business together. And Dayoji and his brother Karsanji, they became devotees, but the other brothers didn't. So in the supermarket where they were getting all the funding, they were selling alcohol, you know, big shelves full of alcohol, and meat, naturally, you know, it's a supermarket. So Madhavisa Swami, he was the GBC there in 75-76, so he came to Mayapur in 1976, and he had a question for Srila Prabhupada about, you know, Dayoji Punja's livelihood, because he wasn't sure, should I say something or not, you know, because he's selling meat and selling liquor. And but at the same time, he was chanting, you know, 16 rounds and following the regulative principles himself. So he was confused. He didn't know what to do, what to say to him. So he asked Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada, he quoted this verse from Bhagavad Gita that every endeavor is covered by some sort of fault. Therefore, one should not give up the work that is born of his nature. So he quoted that, and then he said that if he's chanting, then everything will, you know, eventually be adjusted. And in fact, what happened was a couple of months later, then Dayoji and Karshanji, they actually broke the family business, which normally in India they don't do that. It's like almost like a sacrilege. You know, there's a family business, it's traditional. You just don't do that. But they did it because he on his own came to the conclusion that I cannot tolerate, you know, making money from, you know, these non-devotional items, meat and alcohol. So he broke the business up, gave that supermarket to his other brothers, and then he started up a chain of prasadam restaurants and ice cream parlors on the other side of the island, and he's doing very nicely. So just on his own, you know, he came to that point, but Prabhupada didn't force the issue. So you'll see in like Jagannath Puri, you know, people, they're fishermen, that's what they do, but they're also, you know, devotees of Lord Jagannath. So I don't know what happens to them. You know, they're living in the dham, but they're, you know, they're making a living from fish. They eat fish. And in fact, they mix their fish with the Jagannath Prasad. So what can you do? Therefore, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta made this comment, you know, that if he's not eating urd dal, he must be secretly be eating fish. Because they're so addicted to, you know, the taste. So, you know, even if people are unable to give up that kind of occupation, still you should induce them, you know, to chant and follow the principles. And as the chanting, you know, has that cleansing effect, then eventually they'll get to the point where they'll make their own decisions about the way, you know, the way that they make their livelihood. So, I don't know. If somebody's, you know, if they find it impossible, they're living on the island there, they can't do anything but fish, then what can you do? You still have to get them to chant and practice as much as they can. But generally speaking, nowadays, as I say, you'll see that if somebody really wants to get away from that kind of activity, they can do it. They'll find some other occupation. It's not like, you know, these communities now, we're living in isolation. Practically nobody's living in isolation. You know, you can move somewhere else, you can get another job. You know, 100, 200 years ago maybe, people lived in small communities. They had no transport. It's not like you could ring somebody up, hey, you know, have you got another job for me or something? You know, it was difficult. So you were kind of trapped in the small communities that you were in. But now that's not like that at all. So, anyway, that's as much as I can say on that one. Is that all right? Okay, eating with non-devotees. January the 4th, 1976, we were in this house where these two sisters were there, the meat eaters. So living in someone else's house is difficult when the family members are not a non-Vaishnav. When preaching in India, devotees are often obliged to stay in the homes of life members, their bad habits tolerated in order to broadcast the message of Krishna consciousness. However, Tamal Krishna Maharaj told Srila Prabhupada that when Gargamuni Swami returns to India, he will not do that anymore. Gargamuni had been the temple president in Calcutta, but that year, early part or late 75, early 76, he went back to America to raise funds to buy some vans that they drove overland so that they could, you know, enhance their preaching activities and they could travel all over the country in these vans. So he had sent a message that when he comes back to India, he's not going to stay in the houses of any life members anymore. He is determined that he will not eat in anyone's house. Prabhupada approved. Oh, very good. Not only that, he's not going to sleep in anyone's home either. They want to camp out by the riversides. Oh, very good idea, Prabhupada said. He says that from reading your books, it is very clear that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very careful, strict, to only eat prasadam cooked by proper persons. No, he was actually purchasing from the Jagannath temple, Prabhupada said. People would come to offer him prasadam. So what is the cost? It means to cook for him. So whatever would be the cost of the prasadam, then that was taken and then they purchased from the temple instead. So they calculate, oh, you want to cook a meal for me? So how much are you going to spend? So then that money they would take and then they would go to the Jagannath temple, buy the Jagannath prasadam and then have that. And this was Lord Chaitanya's system. Formerly, Prabhupada said, the system was that there were no hotels, but there were temples. And you can go and you can purchase at a very cheap price. I went with my father in my childhood in a place. So my father would never take food from anyone's house or in the hotel. He will find out some temple and he will pay them and then take the prasadam. Still, there are many temples. So I was about 10 years old at that time, say 70 years ago. So at that time he paid 2 annas to the pujari, which is probably worth about 1 cent nowadays. And he gave us so much, it can be eaten by 5 or 6 men. Khichuri, vegetables, varieties, so much, just 2 annas. And actually, there's still places you can go and you can just buy from the temples. In Calcutta there's a Lakshmi Narayan temple and every day you can go there at certain times. And you just pay a small amount, 10 or 20 rupees, as much as you can eat. And it's all prasadam. It's all been offered to the deities. So it's a nice system. But nowadays, of course, restaurants and these things have become very popular, hotels, etc. But Prabhupada was saying in his childhood, this was the system. Okay, Jagannath prasadam. So I don't know whether I mentioned last night Prabhupada visiting Jagannath Puri, but there was a friend of Prabhupada's, Dr. Shyama Sundar. He lived in Jagannath Puri, and every now and again he would write to Srila Prabhupada and he would send him just a few grains of Jagannath Prasadam. So on November 15th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan and he received a letter from Dr. Shyama Sundar. I thank you very much for kindly remembering me. Sometimes I wish to take Jagannath Prasad, because nowadays I have no appetite here. I went to Jagannath Puri in 1958 on some special function. I was taking Jagannath Prasadam very sumptuously. So I am praying to Lord Jagannath to take me there again at his will and honor his remnants of food. So it's interesting that Prabhupada wrote this in November, because earlier in the year, Prabhupada had been given a report about the activities of our devotees in Bhubaneswar, which is part of Jagannath Puri Dham. It's about 1 hour's drive from Jagannath Puri. And at that time, Bhagwat Das was there, and he was trying to get entry for the Western devotees into the Jagannath Puri temple. And we got some favorable response from the government and from certain members of the Jagannath temple management, but the pandas that were actually controlling the place were dead against it. Because Jagannath Puri is famous, they won't allow anybody unless you're a Hindu, and that even then from certain castes, and everybody else is excluded. So even in Lord Chaitanya's time, that was the system, and therefore Haridas Thakur would never enter the Jagannath temple, although he was living in Puri. He never attempted to do that because he was from a Muslim background. And similarly with Rupa and Sanatan, because they had been ostracized from Hindu society because of their intimate mixing with the Muslims, the Muslim government, they were also barred from entering, you know, Jagannath Puri temple. So Prabhupada told us at that time in 76 that he said, I will not go to Jagannath Puri again until my disciples are allowed into the temple. So that's what he told us. And then you see that in November he's saying, I'm praying to Lord Jagannath to take me there again at his will to honor his remnants. So then later on we went to Bhubaneswar in January. And we were talking about building this temple in Bhubaneswar, but Prabhupada could see that the devotees were more enthusiastic to build a temple in Jagannath Puri. And Gagamuni said that he'd actually looked at different plots of land that were available. And so then Prabhupada said, well, he said, if there's a chance of building our own temple there, he said, then we'll go and we'll see what's available. So on the 25th and 26th of January, Prabhupada did in fact go to Jagannath Puri, and we did in fact eat Jagannath Prasad. So Prabhupada's prayer was answered, even though previously he had said that he wasn't going to go there again unless his disciples could enter the temple. We never did get into the temple, and we never did build a temple there, but the one in Bhubaneswar that they built is very beautiful, Krishna Balaram Mandir. So now it's 7:45, so we're okay. One very interesting incident where Prabhupada was kind of obliged to eat with some life members. Very interesting what happened. So this was December 22nd, 1976. Srila Prabhupada had flown to Bombay, and he was immediately invited to go and visit a house owned by the Malhotra family. The Malhotra family, they actually have a food company. They make jelly powder and, you know, all dry goods, but all strictly vegetarian. Their company is called Wakefields. In India, you can buy their products in many stores. And so they were kind of like a fairly wealthy family. And they had this house in this hill station in Mahabaleshwar, which is, there's a mountain range just above Pune. Pune is a few hours drive south of Bombay. You can also fly down there. So they wanted to give this house to Srila Prabhupada, and so he agreed that he would go there and visit and just see it, just to oblige them. Actually, his health was not good at that time. It was very poor. But still he agreed. So what we had to do was fly from Bombay down to Pune. And it was a tiny little airport. It was like a little prop plane. And when we got there, the airport was actually a tin shack about half the size of this room. That was it. That was the airport. And they received us there at the airport. They drove us to their home in Pune for breakfast before setting out on the trip to Mahabaleshwar, which is several hours from here. The house is large, with a swimming pool, etc. And they are obviously quite rich, although they do not appear to have the traditional culture that the more aristocratic Hindu families have. For breakfast, everyone sat around the table together, and the food was brought out in large bowls and passed around. So now Prabhupada always ate by himself, and he always had his own cook. But because we were with the family, he didn't want to, you know, create any problems, and he wanted to oblige them and encourage them. So he sat down at the table with them, which was very unusual. So everything was brought out in these large bowls and plonked down in the middle. and then the bowls were passed around from one person to another, and everyone was simply helping themselves, dipping in, eating, and then dipping in again, thus completely contaminating everything. Fortunately, I had served Prabhupada with a portion of everything on his plate before anyone had a chance to touch the bowls, so Prabhupada was not affected. I was also careful to only take from the bowls which had been untouched. So that was breakfast. Then we drove up into the hills. It was a tough drive, actually, like a switchback going like this all the way up, very steep, high hills, and about 3 hours. And about an hour and a half of that was just continuously driving like this. Prabhupada got very, very upset, like physically with that. He was almost throwing up because of the continuous curves and bends. Anyway, we made it up to the top. We got to the house. It was it's a simple place, not like elaborate or fancy, but it had 3 or 4 rooms, and it had a fabulous view and a little bit of land. And you could see all the whole valley from, you know, many, many, as far as the eye could see, you could see this plain stretched out below. So Prabhupada said, okay, this is nice. Originally he was going to go for 1 day, but it took so much effort to get up there. So he said, tell them that we'll stay for 3 days. Because the weather was good, he thought, well, you know, I'll get a little healthy here. So they were very happy with that. So then at lunchtime we were invited again to come and eat with them. So lunch was the same as breakfast. Different food, but the same style of eating. This time I made sure that Prabhupada and myself had sufficient so that no seconds would be required. And Giriraj and Gopal Krishna were also careful to do the same. We didn't want to offend our hosts, but we wanted to keep our standards. However, it was still difficult to sit all around the one small table, because gross habits and lusty propensities are all openly displayed when it comes to the matter of satisfying the tongue. You know, people get in there. You know. So it was hardly prasad savor. So then that was the lunchtime. Then in the afternoon, Prabhupada took his rest. When he woke up, then the family decided to go into the town, because their house was a little bit outside Mahabaleshwar. So they all went off into the town except one brother who stayed back, and Prabhupada and myself and Giriraj and Gopal Krishna. So Prabhupada actually, this man, he was wearing this one-piece orange robe down to his ankles, you know, like the typical bright orange Mayavadi color that you see in India. And Prabhupada had asked him at breakfast time, you know, what is the meaning of this robe? This was when we were down in Pune. So he was a follower of this Rajneesh, you know, the so-called Bhagavan Rajneesh. He was very popular in those days. Nowadays he's known as Osho. But in those days he was Bhagavan Rajneesh, and he was a complete, you know, bluffer, Mayavadi. And this man was one of his followers. And actually Rajneesh's main ashram was in Pune. He had a big place there. So this man was a follower, and in those days they used to wear these robes. So Prabhupada asked him, what is this robe? And he said, I am a neo-sannyas. Neo means new. Neo-sannyas. And he said, my wife also is a neo-sannyas. So then Prabhupada sat him down and he explained to him what sannyas actually is. You know, Kudichak, Baudak, Paribrajakacharya, Paramahamsa, and he explained, this is all given in the Vedas. He said, this is sannyas. He said, there's no such thing as neo-sannyas. You can't make up your own process. You know, this is the system. So he listened, he was respectful. Then we drove up. So then in the late afternoon, when everybody went into town, he stayed back. So Prabhupada was looking for something to do. And of course, wherever Prabhupada was, he always wanted to preach. You could never stop him from talking about Krishna. So this man was there, so he immediately called him over, sat him down, and preached to him for about an hour or an hour and a half, just the two of them. I mean, he got so much mercy, this man, from Prabhupada. And at the end of it, by very skillfully explaining the philosophy, then Prabhupada exposed all the flaws in Rajneesh's philosophy. And at the end of it, the man actually admitted that actually, yes, Rajneesh is a cheater. Because he's not giving the real thing. He's just concocting his own processes. And he agreed it was just cheating. So it was nice. Anyway, so then at the end, then the rest of the family came back. So finally, the rest of the family arrived back, and after some light conversation, we were obliged again to sit at the table and eat. This is an Indian thing, you know, 8, 9 o'clock at night, they all get down, and they sit down and they have this huge meal. And many families do this. They don't eat so much in the day, but at night time when they come home from work, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night sometimes, they'll sit down and they have this huge meal. Then they go to sleep, and of course they sleep until 9 o'clock the next morning or 10 o'clock, because they've got so much in their guts. So we were obliged to sit and eat with them. It was about 8 o'clock at night. They laid out some quite heavy foodstuffs, and we took a full meal before retiring for the night. Prabhupada was too polite to say anything, but after everyone had taken rest, he called in Giriraj and myself, and he told us that we should prepare to leave at first light. So he'd said it 3 days, but now he said, now we're going to leave first thing in the morning. He was having difficulty digesting the food, and his system was upset. Also, he's not keen to associate so closely with them. He told us to inform them as soon as they awake that we are very sorry, but Srila Prabhupada is not well, and we have to leave, so we will not be able to stay here after all. So in this way, he said, we can leave in a friendly manner and not upset them. So 23rd of December, next morning. This morning began with the ring of Prabhupada's bell. It was 5 a.m. and we were all still sound asleep. Giriraj and Gopal Krishna didn't even hear the bell. And I only responded because I was trained to listen for it even when I was asleep. So I jumped groggily up from the bed and went in to find Prabhupada sitting at the end of his bed with a small table in front of him that I had set up with his dictaphone and a table lamp. He looked at me when I came in and he asked innocently, "So, you have all become infected like this?" In the background there was a loud snoring coming from the Malhotra's bedroom. So their bedroom was next to where Prabhupada was working. I could hear like this snoring. It was really loud. You could hear it through the whole room. So I was thinking, you know, I was puzzled. My brain was still thick from the heavy sleep. And not realizing what Prabhupada was implying, I said, puzzled, "Well, I don't think that we're as infected as that." You know, the snoring. So without losing his demeanor, Prabhupada said softly, "No, I mean to say, you should have risen at 4 a.m. and bathed and had Mangal Arati. But due to only one night's association, you are already infected." I could understand then his point that association with the Karmis, no matter how friendly, is so dangerous. He told me that this was due simply to eating with the Karmis. The eating process is so important. So he sent me back to our room to wake the others and bathe. And by first light, we were ready for off. Fortunately, the Malhotras were not long in waking up, and after some short discussion, they agreed to allow Prabhupada to use their car to drive back to Bombay, as it was said to be shorter than having to drive back to Pune and then catch a flight. So the idea was that there was Bombay in the north, then there were the mountains, and then Pune in the south. So you could actually drive up either side of the mountains. So we'd flown to Pune, then gone up one side, so then we decided that we'll drive down the other side and go back to Bombay across this flat plain. So they agreed that they would lend Prabhupada their car so that he could do that. Actually, it was also a fact that Prabhupada didn't want to return to Pune because it would have meant having to take prasadam with them again. So after tactfully taking our leave, we all drove down to the village, and Prabhupada had a short walk with them around a small lake before we set off for Bombay proper at 7:45 a.m. It wasn't long before we hit a very twisty section of the road, and although it was all downhill, the progress was slow and difficult. For 1.5 hours continuously, without any break. We had to negotiate one sharp S-bend after another every 50 to 100 meters. So literally turning back on yourself. But for an hour and a half, just going down like this. Prabhupada was in great discomfort, and after a half hour, we had to suddenly stop the car, and Prabhupada vomited out the open door. As we pulled up, I got into great anxiety because I realized that I had not packed any water, and now it would be required for Prabhupada to wash his mouth out with. As I was standing there wondering what to do, by Krishna's mercy, a car suddenly appeared behind us. It was the only vehicle that we had seen in either direction the whole time that we'd been on the road, and it just appeared just when we'd stopped. So they pulled up, and they gladly supplied some fresh water for Srila Prabhupada. After a couple of minutes, we were on our way again, but again after another half hour, Prabhupada was vomiting. Finally, we arrived onto the flat land, and Prabhupada vowed that he would never make such a journey again. After about an hour, Prabhupada had us stop at a village. Now feeling a little better, he wanted some puffed rice, and he had us go out to different stalls and bring back samples of the different puffed rice until he saw some that he thought was fresh enough. He took a little, and then he passed his remnants to us as we drove along. I was a little surprised that he was eating again so soon after throwing up. But Prabhupada smiled, and he said that puffed rice can be eaten at any time, even if one is ill, because it is so innocent. That was the word he used. No, he said it is very innocent. You can eat it at any time. So after a very difficult ride, we arrived back in Bombay at 2:15 p.m. As usual, the devotees were ready with the full arati and foot-washing paraphernalia in his room. But I saw that he was a little dismayed when he came in, although he didn't say anything. So the tradition, at least in Bombay temple, was that it was nice. Whenever Prabhupada arrived there, the devotees would all be assembled in his room. And when he came in, then they would have a full Guru Puja, and they would wash his feet, you know, and have a full-on kirtan. And it would take about half an hour. Then they'd all leave. But this particular day, because of, you know, what had happened in the car, when Prabhupada came in, I saw that, you know, it was going to be difficult for him to sit through the Guru Puja and the foot washing. But he didn't want to say anything because he didn't want to disappoint the devotees. So although he didn't say anything, he didn't want to refuse his disciples' offering of love and devotion, but it was going to be a strain. So I just took it upon myself to stop it. So I therefore ushered everyone out before they could begin, despite one or two protests. But Prabhupada did not object. So I said, I'm sorry. They were just about to start. I said, I'm sorry, Prabhupada's tired. You know, you can't do this. Please go out. So then they were all, you know, naturally the devotees were all upset. But I just said, no, you have to go. And Prabhupada sat there and didn't say anything. So then I knew that he was happy that I was doing it, because he didn't say anything. So he took his massage immediately. As he sat on the small veranda outside his bedroom, he said, I was punished almost immediately for eating with the Karmis. So that was Prabhupada's take on the whole thing, that I was punished immediately for eating with the Karmis. That was why he said he was sick. So I couldn't imagine Krishna punishing Srila Prabhupada for anything, but that was Prabhupada's humility. So that's a valuable lesson, eating with the Karmis. It's a dangerous business, spiritually at least. And these were people that were life members. But Prabhupada said, eating their food, then immediately so many problems. We got contaminated to the point we couldn't get up for Mangal Aarti. And he got affected so badly that he was throwing up. So, other instructions on devotees not taking prasadam food cooked by non-devotees. So, February the 7th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur. During his massage, Prabhupada heard a letter from Balavanta Das, the temple president in Atlanta, in which he learned that the devotees were making a tea from tulsi leaves. Immediately stop it, he exclaimed. He was very disturbed by this news, and he declared that such tea should not be made even for Lord Jagannath during his yearly convalescence. So they had asked, you know, when Lord Jagannath comes off the altar for that fortnight before Rathiatra, then he has a cold, so then the devotees make hot tea, you know, like Brahmastras and stuff like that to help him with his cold. So they asked, can we make a tea from the offered tulsi leaves, not straight off, you know, the tree, but after they've been offered, and offer that to Lord Jagannath, as well as can the devotees drink it, because they heard it was medicinal. Prabhupada was, you know, immediately, stop it. They're very alarmed by that. Prabhupada didn't like what he called the tea drinking habit, because he said it was like the curse of India. Everybody's always drinking tea, you know. They got it from the British. So Balavantara also questioned whether the devotees on traveling Sankirtan could eat bread made by the Karmis. Prabhupada replied that they may not, unless it is an emergency situation. In any event, he said that such food cannot be offered to the deities. As a substitute, he suggested that they eat farina fried in a little ghee with some sugar added. Or, he said, they can make puris, because these would last for 3 or 4 days. So these are the traveling Sankirtan parties. So he didn't like that they were eating grains cooked by the Karmis. So a little later, February the 19th, we're still in Mayapur, because the weather has become quite hot, some visiting devotees are buying flavored ice on sticks from the stalls in front of the temple. Jayapataka Swami asked Prabhupada if we can make our own iced sherbet drink for the Gaur Purnima festival. He is afraid that the devotees will become ill because the local confection is generally made from bad water. Srila Prabhupada was disturbed to hear that the devotees were eating outside. He quite emphatically said, "No one may buy anything from the market. If they eat these things, they will fall down. No one should eat anything not offered to the deity." And actually, I just remembered now, there was an interesting incident that when Prabhupada first arrived, he was walking around and he got near the kitchen area and he saw this man. And he immediately said, "Who is that?" He said, "Fire him immediately." And it was the cook. But Prabhupada, just by looking at him, he said, "He is a demon. Fire him." And it turned out that whatever he was cooking, the devotees were getting very disturbed by. You know, he was cooking all this food, but it was really hot and spicy, and nobody could actually eat it properly. He was a new cook. And Prabhupada, just by looking at him, without knowing that, you know, his cooking was not good, he just said, "Fire him." So he just, from his features, he could understand. Anyway, no one should eat anything not offered to the deity. So then, about 2 weeks later, then the Australian devotees arrived for the festival. And one of them told me that they were buying fruit, you know, from outside. So then I had remembered what Prabhupada had said about, you know, not buying things from the market. So then I put it to Srila Prabhupada and I told him that the Australian devotees are buying this fruit. And I asked him if they should stop. But Prabhupada wasn't disturbed. He replied, "Fruit may be offered within the mind." So on the one hand, he said, don't buy anything from the market, don't eat anything that's not offered to the deities. But then with fruit, he said, no, fruit you can offer within your mind, because it's already complete. There's no preparation or anything. So it doesn't actually even need to be offered to the deities before you eat it. You can just offer it within your mind. I think the old standard we used to Sri Vishnu. and then you can eat it, no problem. So you have to be careful when you hear one instruction from Srila Prabhupada. It doesn't necessarily translate to every situation. You have to know, you know, how he's applying it. The context change. So there was one time a letter from Gopal Krishna about the New Delhi temple. So Prabhupada was in New York in July 76. He received this letter. The Delhi temple had just moved from Bengali markets where they had a very, very tiny small place, and then the lease ran out, so they had to move. They got a new place in another area of Delhi, Lajpat Nagar 3. So he sent this report about, you know, how everything was going. He was very favorable. It was a good place. And they were getting a lot of people attending. So Gopal Krishna asked a question about local women cooking. A few of the women who come are strict Vaishnavs at home. They have offered to cook for the devotees in our kitchen. Is this okay? Srila Prabhupada replied at length. He was glad to hear that many people are attracted in Delhi, and he told him to keep the standard of deity worship high. He was negative in his reply about the local women cooking. Unless one is initiated, they cannot cook, he said. They must be regular disciples, and then they can do deity worship. So there is no question of the outsiders cooking in the New Delhi temple. So that standard has to be there. If you're cooking for the deities, then you must be second initiated. Prabhupada wouldn't accept any other. Even these ladies were already, you know, Vaishnavas by culture and very strict, but still he wouldn't accept them cooking for the deities. So it's 8:05. I think we were going to do. We've done nearly 2 hours. any questions up to this point? Yes, Bruno.
Well, often it is combined together, this cooking and offering food to the deities. But most of us, we live like outside. We don't really like have deities or. So does it change the situation?
Well, yes, naturally, if you can't come to the temple and you're living outside, you should still offer your food, but it's not expected the standard will be as high. When you're worshipping, especially Radha Krishna, then the standard has to be very, very high. But, you know, Prabhupada said if you're worshipping Gaunatai, then the lowest standard for Gaunatai is that you have kirtan. That's it. If you just have kirtan every day, that's acceptable. You don't have to do anything else. And then you can build up from there. But with Radha Krishna worship, you know, that you general standard is, I think, 7 offerings a day, as we do in our main temples. And then also everything very, very high standard, very clean. Everybody has to be twice initiated, etc. Although, when Prabhupada was asked about installing deities in Tehran, because it's, you know, a Muslim country, in those days the Shah of Iran was in charge, the devotees expressed a desire to have deities, but at the same time there were only a few of them, and they wouldn't be able to have the deities for general darshan either, because there was a danger, you know, if the government found out, they would take offense. So they asked Srila Prabhupada if they could install Radha Krishna but have a lower standard. So Prabhupada said that they could do 4 offerings a day, but not less than that. So there is some adjustment even for Radha Krishna. But, you know, the standard for cooking and everything has to be maintained. But when you're at home, I mean, if you're not initiated, then what are you going to do? You have no choice. You still have to offer your food. You know, if you're a bhakta or a first initiate, you still have to offer your food. So, you know, you do your best. Prepare it nicely. Prepare it with the right consciousness. Offer it to a pitcher of Srila Prabhupada or, you know, whoever your aspirant spiritual master is. Gaunatai. And if you do it nicely, then it will be accepted. So it's not, you know, that because you can't offer it to the deities, then, I mean, you know, what are you going to do? Either eat bhog or starve, you know. You have to eat prasadam. So you have to do what you can in the circumstances. Any other, you had a question? Were you just putting your hand up? Somebody was. Yeah, okay.
Well, a little bit of statistics. You know, in Europe, which country has the most numerous devotees?
In Europe, which country has the most devotees? I think Russia. It depends on how you count it. If you count, you know, full-time, initiated, involved devotees, Russia for sure. You know, they just have, last year I was told at their festival that they have on the Black Sea there, they had 4,000 devotees come. I mean, that's a lot. You know, that's practically more than anywhere outside of India. Of course, in India we have the most devotees, but that's natural, and you would expect that. But if you count like congregational members as devotees, or life members, then in Europe, maybe London has the most. You know, they just had their Janmashtami this last few days, last weekend, and they probably had 80 or 90,000 people that came for their Janmashtami. I mean, they make huge preparations. You know, they hire these tents that can hold 4,000 or 5,000 people at a time, and they have several of those, and it's spread over, you know, like several hectares of land. And during the course of the day, at least 80,000 people come for their Janmashtami. So it depends on how you want to count, you know, devotee. But full-time devotees, or, you know, like our situation, Russia probably. And I saw in the Ukraine last year when I was at their festival, which I'm going to this weekend, it begins this weekend, in Odessa, nearly 2,000 devotees. So, you know, quite good. Yes. Yes, Muri and puffed rice. I nearly said my old British accent. Puffed rice. Puffed rice. is the same thing. But not Rice Krispies. Rice bubbles. They have, the Kamis have that breakfast, yeah. Rice Krispies. It snaps as it crackles, as it pops. So, Muri is the same thing. Similar. Any other questions? Yes?
Because you travel so much, do you know, is there in Europe some devotees organized as a physicians or something? In some small, maybe hospital or only in India?
I haven't heard about anywhere outside of Bombay where devotees have organized, you know, healthcare. There is a plan. Giriraj Maharaj is going to provide funds to build a hospice in Vrindavan. So that plan is being drawn up. There are a few devotees that are involved with healthcare that want to, you know, run that hospice. But a hospice, of course, is a place where you go to die. It's not a place where you go to, you know, get relief or something. So that plan is there. But apart from that, at least in the Western countries, I don't know of any devotee-run clinics or hospitals. Certainly not hospitals. There may be some, I'm not sure, but I haven't heard of any. I mean, there's quite a few devotees that are doctors, but as far as I know, they all operate, you know, in a general way, just for the general public. Why? You have something wrong?
She's a doctor.
Oh, you're a doctor. Okay, good. Yeah, I thought maybe you were a patient. We're all patients too. So I don't really know of any at this point. It would be nice if something starts up at some point. Any other questions?
All right, maybe you can share, I mean, this is not really any more prasadam topic, but maybe you can share some, like, your, I don't know, like, realizations or really, like, some thoughts you find that we should really develop in our spiritual life so we can, like, really become strong and survive.
Chant Hare Krishna, follow the regulative principles, eat Krishna prasadam, stay in the association of devotees, come to the temple, do some service. what more can we say? That's how you become Krishna conscious. The more you apply yourself, the more result that you'll, the effect that you'll feel. If you're serious about it, then it's, you know, as Prabhupada said, what is the difficulty? Sometimes he would sit with the devotees and he would say, Krishna consciousness is so nice, what is the difficulty? And what is the difficulty? We make the difficulties ourselves, actually. I mean, I'm speaking from practical experience, you know, how sometimes I make difficulties for myself in my spiritual life. Because we have attachments, we have, you know, bad habits that we're carrying with us from so many previous activities. That takes a little time to get over. But it can be done if you keep yourself in the right situation. So Prabhupada always used to stress that a man is known by his association. If you associate with drunkards, you'll become a drunkard. If you associate with thieves, you'll become a thief. If you associate with devotees, you'll become a devotee. So association is the key thing. It's very difficult if you're by yourself, you know, keeping yourself a little aloof. You might, even if you're very sincere, but there's so much pressure always, you know, from just the atmosphere that we're living in. It's fraught with mundane vibrations, even ones that we can't see. You think back 200 years ago, or maybe even 150 years ago, before electricity was discovered, and try to imagine what it was like, the atmosphere, how peaceful and calm it would have been. No trucks, no buses, no aeroplanes, no electrical wires crisscrossing all around the country, you know, disturbing all the magnetic fields. No radio waves, no TV waves. Even as we're sitting here, the whole atmosphere is completely invaded. You know, you bring a radio and turn it on. Immediately you'll pick up so many different channels. That means that vibration is already in the atmosphere. Wherever you go, you can't get away from it. The whole place is, you know, the whole planet is like that now. So it's very, very difficult, you know, if you're by yourself, to have any kind of peace, and you're under pressure all the time, subtle pressures that you may not even recognize, but they're all the time invading you, you know, your consciousness, and affecting your consciousness. So somehow or another, you have to put yourself in a situation where you get a little relief from that, and where you have a chance, you know, to think about Krishna, do some service for Krishna, you know, and chant Hare Krishna. And therefore Prabhupada made the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He set up temples so we'd have somewhere where we can go where we get a little relief from all that outside pressure. You know, all the advertising and, you know, propaganda that's out there to be, you know, to convince you that you are this body. If you associate with people who think that they are the body, and who think that you are your body, even if they're very nice people, very well-meaning, but they're relating to you as a body, you're obliged to reciprocate with them. It's subtle, but by speech, by action, by emotion, you get entangled in their level of consciousness. They think that you're your body, and they think that they are their bodies. And everything that they do is a reflection of that bodily consciousness. Everything. The way they eat, the way they look at you, the way they hear you, the way, you know, that their emotions reciprocate with yours. It's all on the bodily platform. So even if they may appear to be very, very nice people, the fact is that they're going to degrade you by their association, because it makes it that much harder to maintain the consciousness that I'm not this body, that I'm a spirit soul and a part and parcel of Krishna. But when you sit with a group of devotees, what do you talk about? Hopefully, at least, you'll talk about Krishna or your devotional service. But it's easy to maintain that consciousness of not being the body, you know, of being a spirit soul. When devotees talk together, you immediately get into very deep, you know, heavy topics, philosophical discussions. You try doing that with one of your kami friends. Very difficult to go deep. Everything is very shallow. You know, oh, I did this yesterday and then this happened to me. Oh, I was late for the bus. You know, oh, blah, blah, blah. All mundane katha. You know, what we call gram katha. Village talk. Just gossip. Now, I was saying yesterday that when I flew down on the aeroplane, these two girls, they were in front of me, they didn't stop talking for a single second. Not one second. All mundane. All garbage. You know, oh, this boy's, you know, this guy's this, he's interested in me, or oh, that one's interested in that one. You know, and just endless reams of garbage, that's all. Nothing to nourish the soul. So that's the problem. Even that people may be nice, but the fact is, as Prabhupada said, only the devotees are good. Everybody else is bad. Why? Because they think they are the body, and that's bad. Because you're not the body, that's an untruth. So automatically, just even the way they move, it's, I am this body. Yeah, that's the way they are. See the guys strutting around, showing the muscles, you know, trying to attract the ladies, and the girls are, you know, wiggling around and wearing their, you know, clothes in different ways, and their hair has to go this way or that way, or my eyebrows are not quite right, or my eyelashes are not long enough, or, you know. It's all bodily concept of life. So when you associate with people like that, naturally, automatically, you have to be able to relate to them, you have to be able to, you know, to some degree, come down to their level and be on that same level of consciousness. You can't help it. So, if you really want to make advancement in devotional life, you have to associate with devotees as much as possible. There's no other way to do that. It's very difficult otherwise. Unless, you know, you want to lock yourself away in a cave or something. You know, go up in the mountains here and, you know, sit and meditate. I'll go to India up in the Himalayas. But still you'll be disturbed. And the fact is that our minds have been so absorbed in material things for so long that even if you're by yourself and you try to chant, your mind will not allow you to think of Krishna. It'll immediately go to all the other things, all the old associations, and you'll just become absorbed in thinking of those things. Therefore, Prabhupada condemned devotees that prematurely want to go and, you know, stay in places like Radhakund or Govardhan and these other places, because these are purely spiritual places. But unless you have the deep enough realization to be able to go there and just sit and chant and actually think of Krishna, then he said, what will you do? You'll sit and sleep and think about money and sex. That's all. So what we need then is a situation where we're automatically reminded of Krishna. Even though we're not naturally inclined to think of Krishna, you know, we have so much garbage in our own brains, but by the atmosphere that we're in, we think of Krishna. And that's what we're doing. This is the association that will help us to become fully spiritual. So if you really want to advance in devotional service, be with the devotees. That's the key element, association. All right? Ricardo, problem.
In Vedic culture, what is the best time for eating in one day, the schedule of one day? What is the best eating? for the health, you know?
Well, you have to eat according to the needs of your body. You know, some people can eat just once a day and they're perfectly happy. Some people have to eat three times a day, you know, otherwise they become distressed. Bhagavad Gita says that don't eat too much, don't eat too little. Don't do it artificially. So you have to, you know, you have to see according to your own bodily rhythms what you require. And the Ayurveda, of course, you know, there's the three doshas, the three main components of the body. And according to the bodily makeup and the mixing of the doshas, then you're advised to eat foodstuffs which, you know, complement that. So if you have, you know, like a pitta constitution, then there's certain foods that you would eat that would actually keep you healthy. There's other foods that you would eat that won't keep you healthy. But for another person, they may be the right foods for them. So not everything is for everyone. But you have to, you know, if you're serious about it, you have to see what your body needs and then give the right kind of nourishment. So similarly with the right time as well. There are proper times for eating. There are times when it's not good to eat. Generally speaking, we don't eat after 6 o'clock. You know, or, you know, when the sun goes down, because then the heat in the body reduces when the sun goes down and then you can't digest as easily. Also, it may take several hours, you know, for the food that you've eaten to be assimilated and properly digested. If you have a lot of food in your stomach and then you go to sleep, then you have a lot of dreams. And if you have a lot of dreams, you don't get proper amount of sleep. So then you're not rested, even if you've slept for 6 or 8 hours, because you've been dreaming too much. So it's best if you can avoid eating after 6 o'clock at night, because then by the time you take rest, there's nothing in your stomach that needs digesting. Then you have a better chance to have a, you know, proper sleep. So there's a lot of items like that, and if you, you know, if you get into it, then Ayurveda gives a lot of details about that. Any other questions? Okay, it's 8:30. Is there a little prasadam? Now I've just said don't eat after 6 o'clock. Is there a little prasadam for everybody? Yes? Oh no? There's no prasadam? How can you do that?
We are happy not to take.
Anyway, the principle is that if there's a gathering, there must always be prasadam distribution. Always. Prabhupada was very, you know, strict about that. It's not complete if you don't have prasadam. So anyway, nothing tonight, but maybe tomorrow. Some arrangement. Something, you know, cookies, milk, whatever. But there should always be distribution of prasadam if there's a gathering of devotees. Huh? He's the prasadam man is here. All right, so anyway, we'll finish tonight. Tomorrow, Bhagavatam class in the morning. And then again tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, then we'll continue reading about other aspects of prasadam. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.